VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Tensions continue to soar in the Middle East following the assassination of a top Hamas terrorist leader in Tehran last week and a rocket strike on Israel's Golan Heights that killed a dozen youths the day before. Israel blamed the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah for the attack and struck what it said were Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. The Hezbollah commander was killed. VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Despite the finger-pointing, there are real-world consequences for people living in the region. Israel's Iron Dome air defense system triggered over the weekend to intercept attacks from across the border in Lebanon. And with military reinforcements on the way, the State Department issued a do-not-travel advisory for Lebanon, encouraging U.S. citizens to depart. Arash Arabasadi. VOA News.
Dozens of people have been killed and scores injured in clashes in Bangladesh Sunday. Police fired tear gas and lobbed stun grenades to disperse tens of thousands of protesters calling for the prime minister to resign. Lauren Anthony with Reuters.
Last month, at least 150 people were killed and thousands more were injured and arrested in violence sparked by demonstrations led by student groups protesting against quotas for government jobs. The Interior Ministry declared an indefinite nationwide curfew starting at 6 p.m. local time on Sunday. It's the first time it has taken such a step during the current protest. The unrest is the government's biggest test since deadly protests erupted after Hasina won a fourth straight term in January elections that were boycotted by the main opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party. Critics of Hasina, along with human rights groups, have accused her government of using excessive force to stamp out the movement, a charge she and her ministers deny.
North Korea has marked the delivery of 250 nuclear-capable missile launchers to frontline military units, as leader Kim Jong-un said his country should prepare for prolonged confrontations with the United States. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Karen Shamus reports an unrest in England as far-right rioters clash with police.
Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer has strongly condemned an attack on a hotel housing asylum seekers. Protesters threw objects including bits of wood, chairs and fire extinguishers at police officers in the English town of Rotherham. They also attempted to break into the hotel housing asylum seekers as surrounding crowds of far-right protesters cheered them on. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer called their actions far-right thuggery. His comments come as a wave of violence broke out in several towns and cities across the country. The violence came in the wake of a stabbing rampage at a dance class that left three girls dead and many more wounded in Southport. Protesters also clashed with police in the northern town of Middlesbrough. Karen Chamas, London.
Nigeria's leader has called for an end to mass protests over economic hardship, saying the rallies have turned violent and blamed a few with political agenda for driving them. Details from VOA's Joe Ramsey.
The protests, which began on Thursday, continued on Sunday after the request by Nigerian President Bola Tinubu. The protests have been accompanied by reports of looting and vandalism, as well as accusations security forces have used excessive force. Amnesty International has reported the deaths of nine protesters in clashes with police, while another four were killed by a bomb. The Nigerian police deny the amnesty report. The protests reflect frustration with the worst cost of living crisis in a generation and accusations of misgovernment and corruption in Africa's most populous country. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 stock index has fallen as much as 7.1% before recovering some lost ground, extending sell-offs that shook markets last week. The index was down about 6% as the market began a midday break. Stocks tumbled Friday on worries the U.S. economy could be cracking under the weight of high interest rates meant to whip inflation. Early Monday, the futures for the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials were down more than 1%. Tropical Storm Debbie has now strengthened to a Category 1 hurricane as it heads toward the U.S. state of Florida. Forecasters at the National Hurricane Center say the storm has now maximum sustained winds of 75 miles per hour. The storm has already brought rain and flooding to much of Florida's Gulf Coast. Forecasters warn it will likely also thrash the Atlantic coast of the states of Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina with rain. And catastrophic flooding is expected in some areas. Debbie is a fourth named storm of the 2024 Atlantic hurricane season. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Monday, August 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Tinubu calls for dialogue over protests.
Under the circumstances, I hereby enjoin protesters and the organizers to suspend any further protests and create room for dialogue.
Liberian government denies running a witch hunt against officials of former President George Weah's government. South African President Ramaphosa explains why the ANC did so poorly in the May 29 election. Somalia says it has made some arrests, including security officers, for alleged negligence following Friday's Al-Shabaab attack.
This is a very difficult attack to prevent, in my assessment. This attack was implemented by one individual wearing a suicide vest, five attackers with AK-47s and hand grenades.
And U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is set to announce VP pick soon, and Trump wants a different debate venue. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu has called for an end to protests that began on Thursday and urged protesters to create space for a dialogue on how to help the country. However, many Nigerians say his comments made in a televised speech on Sunday did not address the demands of the protesters. Our reporter in Abuja, Nigeria, has more on the president's address.
In his address to the nation, President Bola Tinubu extended his condolences to the Nigerians whose relatives have lost their lives in the protests.
I am especially pained by the loss of lives in Borno, Jigawa, Kano, Kaduna, and other states, the destruction of facilities in some states, and the wanton looting of supermarkets and shops, contrary to the promise of protest organizers that the protest will be peaceful across the country.
Tinubu emphasized his commitment to public order, highlighting his constitutional duty to protect the lives and property of all citizens. He called on the protesters to suspend further demonstrations.
Under the circumstances, I hereby enjoin protesters and the organizers to suspend any further protests and create room for dialogue, which I have always acceded to at the slightest opportunity. Nigeria requires all hands on deck and needs us all, regardless of age, party, tribe, religion, or other divides.
Tinubu said the economic reforms his government has undertaken, including the removal of fuel subsidies and the abolition of multiple foreign exchange systems, were needed to remove a noose around the economy. However, many Nigerians blame those reforms, which were meant to cut the government's debt, for rising hardships across the country. The protesters want the government to ease the economic problems, which include a rapidly rising cost of living, high unemployment, and a plunging currency. There were mixed reactions to the president's address. Ezenwanwagu, chairman of the group Partners for Electoral Reform, said there was no established way for the president to engage with the protest organizers.
The president simply addressed general issues, especially as it has to do with some of his accomplishments, his assumption to office. And the basis for that is that there are no recognized platforms of engagement, because the issues by the so-called protesters are also general.
Emmanuel Igbini is the national president of the organization Vanguard for Transparent Leadership and Democracy. He said the president's speech did not talk about the protesters' demands.
Personally, I did not find his address, with due respect, inspiring at all. It did not address in any way the genuine concerns of millions of Nigerians who are facing undeniable hunger, hopelessness, and frustration.
Tinubu's speech came after calls from some stakeholders and opposition parties to address the protesters. The End Bad Governance protest kickstarted August 1 across Nigeria, driven by public dissatisfaction with current economic and social conditions. There have been reports of more than 17 killed in protest-related violence around the country. The Inspector General of Police on Friday said the deaths include at least one police officer. For VOA News from Abuja, Nigeria.
A spokesperson says the Liberian government is now running a witch hunt against officials of former President George Weah's government. President Joseph Boakai's government recently issued writs of arrest or removed some Weah government officials from their positions for alleged corruption. They include former Finance Minister Samuel Tuah and Central Bank of Liberia Governor J. Aloysius Talu. Information Minister Geraldine McPierre tells me that the Boakai government will not hesitate to go after proven corrupt officials, former or president or present.
The Boakai government is not witch hunting anyone. It will not make witch hunting a part of its programs and policies. However, if the Boakai administration got reports, be it from the GSC, be it from the LACC, be it from other anti-graft institutions that indicate that there are people who breached the public trust, and the Ministry of Justice determines that prosecutorial actions are possible so as to hold people accountable, that's exactly what the administration will do.
But the other way is that there was no due process, or there's no due process.
Well, it depends on what you or they interpret as due process. Take, for example, the situation that led to charges being brought against Mr. Tuah and others. An investigation was done by the LACC. LACC is the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission. All the commissioners who are currently serving that commission were appointed by former President Weah, not President Boakai. They did an independent investigation. They found evidences of wrongdoing. They worked along with the Ministry of Justice to bring charges against people based on their report. And now, as they've been charged, they are supposed to go to court. Is that not due process? Or is there another definition of due process?
What do you make of former President Weah's speech recently that the CDC, if this continues, may put up resistance to the so-called government witch hunt?
So the first thing I would say, Mr. Weah is in a self-destruction mood because Friendly Bote, he dropped the ball. If something is done consistent with audits reports that are available from people you appointed and you have a disagreement, you would think that a man who has been former president of a country will follow the footsteps of what, say, Aloysius Talu is doing, what folks who came from the LTA did, and what other people who believe that the rule of law is the surest way of maintaining peace and stability will do. Rather than doing that, he comes to issue threats, to talk about resistance. He dropped the ball terribly.
Liberia's Information Minister Geraldine McPierre was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. An official of the Opposition Coalition for Democratic Change, the CDC of Liberia, says President Joseph Boakai's government is using the judicial system to further political aims. The Boakai government recently issued writs of arrest or removed from office some officials of former President George Weah's government for alleged corruption. Eugene Nabwe is the chair of the CDC National Executive Committee. He tells means that former President Weah is a man of peace who operated within the confines of the Liberian laws during his administration.
The government of Liberia under the then leadership of former President Weah have always been in the interest of peace, in the interest of accountability, but it is quite surprising that this new government under President Boakai has resorted to using the judicial system to further political aims. And why are we saying this? You just told me that these people were order arrested. It will surprise you to note that they were order arrested, and even as we speak, the Ministry of Justice is now going around calling people to convene an emergency grand jury to present evidence to that jury. It is an inverted way of doing things. Why would you arrest somebody without even adducing evidence before the grand jury in keeping with Liberian law? So when President Weah spoke, he condemned this and many other actions by the Boakai government to use the judicial system and violate the laws of our country.
I spoke to Information Minister Pia, and he thinks that President Weah coming out speaking the way he did, that itself is a threat of violence.
Well, you listen to President Weah. He said that he will take actions within the confines of the Constitution of the Republic of Liberia in keeping with the legal process, and he will utilize all of the political means available to him, which are guaranteed also by our Constitution. How is that an urge to violence? You know, it is the violation of Liberian law by the government of Liberia that is causing unrest, insecurity, because where there is no rule of law, there is no peace. Where there is a violation of our constitution, of our legal system for political ends, that is the threat to peace in Liberia, and not President Weah coming out to speak against the ills that have been perpetrated by this government. That's not what causes violence.
Eugene Nambo is the chair of the Opposition Coalition for Democratic Change, or CDC, National Executive Committee of Liberia. He was speaking with us from Accra, Ghana. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Buffy in Washington. Today is Monday, August 5th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Somalia's Prime Minister Hamza Abdi Barre says some arrests have been made, including security officers, for alleged negligence following Friday's complex al-Shabaab attack on a crowded beach and a hotel, which claimed the lives of 37 people and injured dozens of young beach goers. But the government also is being criticized for failing to prevent the attack. Reporter Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Language Service spoke to regional security analyst Samira Gayal.
You have to look at this attack in context of the last 2 years. The security forces in Somalia have put al-Shabaab under siege, I would say, over the last 2 years, but in the periphery, outside of the capital. And al-Shabaab has not had any space within the capital up until now, where we have seen that offensive operations outside the capital have stopped, and then they came back to the capital to try and, you know, target the government and international community. Unfortunately, the government and international community installations are hard targets, and the soft targets they have is in public areas like this. That's the first thing. The second thing is the public had been a bit more confident in the abilities of the Somali security forces. There was a bit of a vision that this end of the Artemis mission is in the horizon, that the Somali security forces and the government was taking charge. This is a statement by them to the public, but is that it's still the same. Nothing has changed. Al-Shabaab is very much in place, and they need to, you know, strike terror back where it was.
Why do you think the security forces failed to prevent this attack?
This is a very difficult attack to prevent, to be honest, in my assessment. This attack was implemented by one individual wearing a suicide vest, five attackers with AK-47s and hand grenades. Over the past week, I was in Mogadishu. Security was very tight along the streets. Security forces were doing their checks. I personally went through these checks where you come out of the car and your vehicle is checked, and they had information about some sort of attack that was imminent. So the security forces had information. But when you're talking about terror attacks of this kind, especially in a public place, there's really so much that you can do if you do not have accurate intelligence. So I really believe the big question is how the VBID vehicle got to the place that it got to, passing all those checkpoints. But I do not see any difficulty in the group getting AK-47s, hand grenades, and possibly a suicide vest across town.
That's regional security analyst Samira Gay speaking with reporter Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Language Service. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the African National Congress, the ANC, performed poorly in the May 29th election because many people in some of the country's large cities, such as Johannesburg, Pretoria, and Durban, withheld their votes out of dissatisfaction with the provision of services where they live. He spoke Sunday at the opening of the ANC National Executive Council, NEC Lakota. Now, political analyst Professor Sipho Sipe tells me the ANC should have begun its assessment or self-assessment by first owning its failures.
Any assessment must start with a bit of honesty. And I think the ANC has been dishonest about its failures. To start finding fault with municipalities, and they also find fault with many others, is an attempt to evade taking responsibility. The polls were always indicating that the ANC is not going to do well unless the ANC does something. So what we have here in this so-called self-assessment is the failure of leadership to take responsibility for the outcome.
But Professor, can we say it is never too late? The fact that the ANC has made a self-assessment, that itself is honorable.
Well, it depends. The self-assessment must start being honest, because if you're not honest, you're going to make the same mistake that had led to this loss. But if you become dishonest, the very things that made it difficult for you to address the challenges will continue to remain.
The ANC right now is in a government of national unity. How would they put into practice this self-assessment within the context of a government of national unity?
Well, this is where the difficulty is, because if you look at the government of national unity, you have parties that have made it their business to ensure that the ANC fails. And the DA has actually said, the leader of the DA, that in her lifetime, she will live to see the ANC dead, kaput, no longer a party worth voting for. So the challenge is, how do you work with people who desire your own downfall?
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is reportedly narrowing down her choices for a running mate in the 2024 presidential race. Her new vice presidential pick will join her at a campaign event on Tuesday in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. Also, former President Donald Trump took it to social media to make his case on why there should be a change in venue and the date for the next presidential debate. Viewer Veronica Baldera Iglesias has the details.
Anticipation is growing about who U.S. Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris will choose as her running mate in the 2024 presidential race. Top contenders include Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and U.S. Senator Mark Kelly. Duke University political scientist John Green told VOA via Skype that the VP selection will be the U.S. voters' first impression of Harris's judgment as the potential 47th president of the United States.
It signals a lot about her and her priorities and her approach to governing in terms of who she would, you know, put in her stead if for any reason she were not able to discharge her duties as president.
Harris plans to tour several battleground states with her VP pick, starting Tuesday in Pennsylvania. The Trump campaign is also expected to continue investing time and energy in states that could decide the outcome of the November general election. Analyst John Green via Skype.
This time around, states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona are both relatively large and seen as being particularly competitive.
As the U.S. electorate awaits announcement, there's also renewed interest on whether Harris will debate her political rival and former president Donald Trump. The Republican presidential nominee argues that now that President Joe Biden dropped out of the race, the original presidential debate, scheduled for September 10th on ABC, should be replaced by a Fox News one in Pennsylvania in early September with a live audience. On Saturday, Trump wrote on his Truth social media platform, quote, "I'll see her on September 4th, or I won't see her at all." The Harris campaign has been adamant they should stick to the original debate plan.
Well, Donald, I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say,
whether Harris and Trump will come face to face remains to be seen. But former President Trump will have a new opportunity to make his case against Harris and her new running mate when he rallies in Bozeman, Montana on August 9th. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for a recap of sports, and here is Samson Omalu in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the latest news from the Paris Olympics. It was a historic day for Africa on Sunday as Algeria's Kayla Namoah became the first African gymnast to win an Olympic medal when she secured the gold with a breathtaking routine on the asymmetric bars at the Paris Games on Sunday that wowed the crowd in Bercy Arena. The 17-year-old's fast-paced routine featuring a number of complex release and catch maneuvers delighted the crowd who came to support a gymnast who had previously represented France. Fans roared and jumped to their feet as soon as Namoah completed her dismount from the asymmetric bars. She immediately broke down in tears as she handed Algeria their first medal of the Paris Olympics, with her performance scoring a staggering 15,700 points. In basketball, Nigeria's women basketball team, the Tigres, became the first team from the African continent, men or women, ever to reach the quarterfinals of an Olympic basketball tournament on Sunday. The Nigerians clinched their place in the last eight by beating Canada 79-70 at the Pierre Maurice Stadium near Lille. The win means Nigeria are guaranteed to finish among the top three in Group B, but the Canadians were eliminated without registering a single victory. The Nigerians outscored the Canadians 23-5 in the third quarter, where U.S.-born Izin Nekalu top scored with 21 points and Elizabeth Balogun scored 14 points. The women's quarterfinals will be played on Wednesday. In football news, the potential for an all-African final of the men's Olympic football tournament at the Paris 2024 Olympic Games is just within reach as Egypt and Morocco play in the two semifinal matches on Monday. Morocco made history at the Paris 2024 Olympics, reaching their first ever men's football semifinal with a commanding 4-0 victory over the United States on Friday. Another North African side, Egypt, secured their first ever semifinal berth in a tense 5-4 penalty shootout victory over Paraguay. Morocco will play Spain, while Egypt will play the host nation France on Monday. Should both Morocco and Egypt triumph in their respective semifinals, it will guarantee Africa its third gold medal in men's Olympic football. South Africa long jumper Jovan van Vuuren revealed on Sunday he was the victim of a personal attack, which included death threats via WhatsApp messages the day before he was due to compete at his first Olympic Games. Van Vuuren explained that he had taken screenshots of the messages and saved the number of the attacker, who also tried to phone him around 5 p.m. on Saturday. The 28-year-old said he didn't want to make excuses for not making it through the long jump qualification on Sunday, but that he had been mentally shaken by the messages, which included personal details about his family and his best friend who had died by suicide in 2018. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, August 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week. Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in brief, airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date.
Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.